soft-shoulder rabbit.
A zebra.
Are we a safe distance from this?
Probably not.
I would never, ever dare say that out loud.
Hack on Triple J.
Hey, Tom Tilley here. You're about to meet a member of the Australian bobsled team. Just don't mention the Jamaican bobsled team.
Yeah, we try to avoid that comparison. But of course, because of the lack of ice in Australia, they definitely compare us with the Jamaicans and Cool Runnings.
Also today on Hack, you're going to find out how you could get to the Winter Olympics without all the dedication and training. First up, did you hear the debate about the African gang violence in Melbourne around New Year's?
The reality is, you know, people are scared to go out to restaurants at the night time because they're followed home by these gangs. Home invasions and cars are stolen, and we just need to call it for what it is. Of course it's African gang violence.
Triple J.
Yeah, that was the Home Affairs Minister, Peter Dutton. And his comments pissed a lot of people off, and not just people in the Sudanese community. Even the Victorian police came out and disagreed with him. So, a month on, what impact has that whole argument had? Well, to find out, Joe Lauder's in Melbourne, getting deep with the African community.
So, I play soccer. I'm my African gang, you know? Even me too, I was thinking while I was landing on the airport, oh, I'm part of African gang now. You know what I mean? My name is Anya Kaviel, South Sudanese born, and I've been in Australia now for more than 14 years. I'm working now part-time as a youth worker, and I'm also going to uni studying a double degree in criminology and psychology.
When Anyak came home after a holiday this summer, he landed in a very different political situation to the one he'd left.
Too scared to go out at night. That's Peter Dutton's assessment of Melburnians living in the city's west.
Over Christmas, there was a string of incidents involving young people of different African backgrounds and the police, including a house party where the Airbnb was trashed and a teenager who kicked a policeman in the face. After that, the federal government went on the attack, saying African gangs in Melbourne were out of control.
We just need to call it for what it is. Of course it's African gang violence.
It's a real and pressing problem.
The reality is, you know, people are scared to go out to restaurants at the night time because they're followed home by these gangs.
We are very concerned at the growing gang violence and lawlessness in Victoria, in particular in Melbourne.
That kind of reporting really kills young people's motivation. First, to be something of themselves and to be part of society as a whole.
But it's not the first time this kind of thing has happened. In 2016, at the Moomba Festival in Melbourne, a violent brawl broke out between two different groups of teenagers in Melbourne's CBD, and things quickly turned nasty. One of the groups was the Apex Gang.
We know that in the aftermath of that a lot of the violence was blamed on the South Sudanese community, and in particular focused on the Apex Gang. In inverted commas.
That's Dr. Catherine Bernier. She's a criminologist at Monash University. After Moomba, the police cracked down hard on the groups involved in the brawl. Then, last April, Victoria Police announced that the Apex Gang was no longer around and that it was never just made up of African kids. But
we know that the political and the media reactions to that event were completely disproportionate to the levels of violence that we actually saw.
Catherine and two other criminologists at Monash University are studying the consequences of the so-called Moomba riot and the intense political and media attention on the South Sudanese community since then.
The politicians were talking about this issue, the police were talking about this issue, the broader community were talking about the issue, but no one had really asked the South Sudanese young people how this was sort of affecting their daily lives.
So that's what they've been doing.
Well, the most prominent theme that keeps coming up in our research is just a sense of frustration, even a sense of despair.
One teenage girl involved in the research has reported being spat on in public, and others say they've been the target of hate speech.
The stereotyping, the prejudice, some of the young people that we've spoken to have been the targets of hate speech in the community. They feel that they have an increased surveillance on them. They feel like people are always watching them, sort of waiting for them to act up.
And Catherine says the young people think this intense scrutiny on their community is making it harder for them to get jobs or the same education opportunities as everyone else.
They just feel like the opportunities that are ahead of them in Australia are quite limited. When we were talking to sort of 15 and 16-year-olds who are sceptical about their ability to get, you know, any sort of employment when they're leaving school, again, that's quite frustrating for us as researchers as well. One of the girls was telling us that she put in pretty much the same resume at the same time as one of her Caucasian friends, not surprisingly, perhaps, the Caucasian girl got a call back for an interview. And when they asked the South Sudanese girl about her background, they were quick to sort of shut her down for her opportunities for that.
Anyak agrees, and he's seen this amongst the young people that he works with.
With the portrayal of young people in the media, especially of African background, also just kind of increased the chances of people being, covertly racist to them or overtly racist to them, and also finding opportunities for employment as well as trying to fit in some other areas in the society.
And it's not just about jobs. Anyak is worried that this focus on race is affecting the mental health of young people and their identity.
I'm well aware that it is affecting young people, and especially with the identity and the sense of belonging, because most of young people that I'm working with are born here. They're born in Australia, and when they hear such comment that they're being put in a position that they are not more Australian, you know what I mean? Even though they're well aware that they are born here.
The South Sudanese community has reported the highest levels of discrimination in Australia. In the Scanlon Foundation survey, 77% of South Sudanese participants had experienced racism, the highest percentage.
People always say, this community went through it. And what I say to myself is that, well, if all this community went through this kind of experience of being isolated or being portrayed in a negative form, then Australia got a problem. So why don't we fix that problem?
Hack Triple J.
South Sudanese-born Anyak Avil from the Centre of Multicultural Youth. Ending that story from Joe Lauder. Nidal Nguyen is a Sudanese lawyer working in Melbourne. I want to get her reaction to this whole saga. Nidal, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
How did that media coverage around New Year's make you feel personally?
Well, initially quite disappointed, frustrated, and then after a while just hurt. Hurt for the many South Sudanese people I know that were felt targeted, felt vilified, felt scared. And I think also hurt for the prospect. But because, thinking long term, I've got young brothers here. We consider this to be home, and just feeling hurt because you are made to feel as if this is not home, and everything that you've kind of built on and believed in as you try to rebuild your life here, because we came as refugees, that really didn't amount to much, so those were my first initial emotional reactions. But with time, I think you try to think more constructively and you think, what can I practically do? And for me, I think that has been more in terms of advocacy and trying to provide whenever I can an alternative narrative.
Wow, it's amazing to hear that it made you question your whole journey from being an asylum seeker in Africa to coming here in Australia. Just a few potentially kind of offhand comments from some of our politicians. It's really quite sad. And we heard in that story from Joe Lauder about the way people are discriminated against when it comes to getting a job. What are some of the other impacts that this kind of discussion has on people from your community?
A lot of it has been canvassed in some of the conversations I've heard the people talking about just now. So issues of mental health, some of the discussions we've been having are the kind of impact that it have on self-esteem and self-worth of young South Sudanese people. And you've got to think, and just picture for a moment that, you've got 16-year-olds in your home, and over a period of a month, all they get to see is negative imagery of people who look like them, and very few opportunities for people who look similar like them saying anything positive. And then on top of that, having powerful people, powerful politicians with very powerful platforms saying, speaking in a manner that doesn't have the nuance to allow for a different narrative. So you just imagine for a young child facing that when you're already trying to find your own fit in a country, when you're trying to find out who you are and what you're interested in. So that has been some of my concern, particularly in that I think that's connected to issues of mental health generally.
No doubt.
A lot of conversation in the Sudanese community as well about just a sense of isolation and the sense of
That's
sense
an interesting
of powerlessness.
Point. I wonder about that, because these comments make people withdraw. They make them feel more isolated, like they're not part of our community here in Australia. Do those comments then potentially, that the politicians make, then become a self-fulfilling prophecy, because that's the impact they might have on someone? And they're the sort of things like social dislocation, mental health problems that sometimes can lead people to commit crimes.
Look, I'm not sure whether I can make particularly that inference, but what I've witnessed, and this is not the first time that the Sudanese communities, African communities, have had this kind of intense media and political commentary that was similar things in around 2007. What I've been able to observe is that people do become conscious of occupying public spaces, whether it's going to the shopping center, whether it's, taking a bus, because you're just more aware of the fact that people who look like you have, there's a narrative now established that are likely to be prone to violence and not necessarily trustworthy members of the community. So it's strange, because it's a small group of young people that are engaged in this kind of behavior. But by the way in which politicians and I think the media cover this, it's putting, making it difficult for the majority of the people that are doing good to continue to integrate into the community and to feel as being part of this community, which I think is fundamentally important going forward.
Yeah, so, you're getting a bit of support on the text line here at Triple J. One person says, I work in the area the Apex gang originated, and I can definitely tell you those views are overwhelmingly white. Another person says, I'm a white Australian female and I went to school at Mount Alexander College. As one of only two white people in the year level, Mr. Dutton's comments make me feel sick to the stomach. I love the experience I had in high school and learned so much from the perspective going to school with so many African and mixed race people. So a bit of positivity coming through there, Nidal. I hope your community
keep them coming.
Keep
them coming,
right?
Because they matter. It does. It feels good, and it matters. It matters for members of Sudanese community to hear this. It's a kind of a welcoming turn, because it's not like that. My experience, particularly online, it's been very, 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 very bad. Just overt racist commentary, things like, and some of it quite violent as well.
Yeah, well, someone's backing you up on that as well. They say the public only became so frightened of African news after the media kept pumping and exaggerating all the bad stories. It's actually racism what the media has done. So some interesting questions for the media as well as the politicians. No, Dole, we're out of time. Thank you so much for speaking to us.
Thank you for having me.
That's Nidal Nguyen, who's a South Sudanese Australian lawyer, working hard in her community trying to bounce back after some negative media coverage over Christmas.
Hack. Triple J.
Now, coming up, you're going to meet a member of the Australian bobsled team, and they have a very interesting pre-race butt-tapping ritual. You'll find out what the hell's going on about there. First up, how's your relationship with your smartphone?
Hack.
I've seen psychiatrists and therapists for most of my life.
A lot of males don't talk about it.
Mental health is health.
This needs to be an open dialogue.
On Triple J.
Yeah, do you love your smartphone, or does it actually fill you with a bit of anxiety? Or does it do a bit of both? There's a constant debate about whether our smartphones are good or bad for our mental health. And the woman you're about to meet says they're very bad for us. So is she right, or is she just another old person who doesn't get it? Send me a text, 0439 757 555. Her name is Jean Twenge. She's a psychologist from America. She's written some very well-known books, and she wrote an article last year for The Atlantic about this whole issue, and it went totally viral. Her book is called iGen, Why Today's Super-Connected Kids Are Growing Up Less Rebellious, More Tolerant, Less Happy, and Completely Unprepared for Adulthood. Professor Twenge, thank you so much for joining us on Hack.
Thank you.
You could see this book as a wake-up call for a generation, or just another wowser blaming the latest technology for the problems of a whole generation. So which is it?
Well, I think it's much more about listening to young people and hearing what they have to say about how they're spending their time and about how they're feeling and their emotions. You know, it's based on surveys of 11 million young people here in the States. They're having experiences that I think a lot of young people and older people, for that matter, are having around the world as so many people have smartphones.
Yeah, let's start by talking about the group of people that you're talking about. You've called this generation iGen. Who are they?
So iGen is the generation born between 1995 and 2012. They are the first generation to spend their entire adolescence with smartphones. And I've been looking at generational differences for about 25 years and started looking at Gen Xers compared to previous generations, then moved on to millennials. And I look at these big national surveys. And around 2012, I started to notice some really big shifts among these teen samples who are 13 to 18 years old. They started to say that they were spending less time hanging out with their friends in person. They started to say that they felt useless and that they couldn't do anything right. There was a sudden spike in agreement with those types of attitudes. Those are classic symptoms of depression. So that made me think, with teens spending their time so much differently, so much more time on screens, less time with their friends face-to-face, maybe that's why these mental health issues are showing up.
You join up a bunch of research that shows iGen are essentially growing up later, getting licenses later, having sex later, going out less, spending more time with their parents, more time at home, starting part-time jobs later. What do you see as some of those key trends there?
Yeah, so iGen is growing up more slowly. So, for example, as you were mentioning, iGen teens, by the time they're 17 or 18, they are less likely to have a driver's license, to go out with their parents, to have a paid job, to date, to have sex, and to drink alcohol. So a lot of these trends are certainly a good thing. The potential downside is then when they arrive at university or their first job, they're going to have less experience with independence.
The darker side of this story is a rising anxiety, depression, and even suicide amongst this generation. What did you observe in the mental health space?
In looking at these large national surveys, I did, as I mentioned, start seeing this kind of sudden spike in these symptoms of depression. I also started to see a sudden spike in loneliness. Levels of happiness started to turn down. Then I started to find out that this pattern wasn't just in these surveys. It was appearing in a national screening study of clinical level depression, which has increased by 50% since 2011. The suicide rate among teens has also increased over the exact same time period. And for the youngest teens, 12 to 14 year olds, especially girls, it's really spiked. It's tripled in that age group.
So how much impact do you think the smartphone and all that it allows access to, social media, the internet, is to blame for those, I guess, more alarming trends?
So I think it's a cascade effect that the advent of the smartphone meant that teens started to spend a lot more time on social media, texting. It just means more screen time. That seems to correlate with negative mental health outcomes. It crowds out time for other things.
Hack. Triple J.
That was psychologist Professor Jean Twenge on her latest book, iGen. And if that interview made you realize you have a problem that you need help with, you can call Lifeline, get help right now, 13 11 14. Let's go to an Australian psychologist who also works in the area of mental health and mobile devices for a second opinion on that one, because Professor Twenge was pretty negative about the impact of the smartphone. Bridie O'Day, you're from the Black Dog Institute in Australia. Do you have a bit more of an optimistic view on that topic?
Yeah, well, I think the key thing is that correlation doesn't equal causation. And, she admits that when she's talking about this, and that there are plenty of other reasons that are perhaps more convincing for why we've seen an increase in mental health diagnoses. And we know that young people themselves are becoming much more aware of mental health problems. Parents are becoming more aware of the symptoms. Schools are becoming more aware. The general community is becoming more aware. And really, in my research at the Black Dog Institute, we've found that young people are actually turning to their phones for support, and that they prefer to use their phone because it's easier, private, more convenient. They can get a range of access to different types of support, and they can access it anywhere and any time. And so from my point of view as a researcher in mental health, mobile phones are actually a real game changer for improving the mental health of young people. And, you know, we found a new way to deliver high quality care to lots of young people who are currently not getting access to care.
Yeah, well, that's really encouraging. Bridie, thanks for joining us. That's Bridie O'Day from the Black Dog Institute. On the text line, Ben from Melbourne, you say, I'm 21. I think smartphones are killing our ability to socialise. I've stopped looking at my phone during social situations. Another listener, you say, the constant need for instant gratification from smartphone notifications is like a drug user's hit.
Hack on Triple J.
Tomorrow night, the opening ceremony of the Winter Olympics kicks off. Pretty exciting. Now, the Winter Olympics is full of sports that most of us have never tried, like bobsled racing. And Australia has a 2- and 4-man bobsled team, and 22-year-old David Murray from Perth is in both teams. And I'm speaking to him from inside the Olympic Village in Pyeongchang. David, thank you for joining us there. What's it like being there one day out from the opening ceremony?
It's a pretty amazing feeling, to be honest. Just walking around the village right now, and it's awesome having all these other countries so close, living together, competing together, eating together. It's awesome.
And what does the village look like, and what's it like hanging out there?
There's quite a few temporary buildings, but there's probably about 10 massive high-rises here in the Pyeongchang village, and it's quite a stunning view.
Okay, and being in a bobsled team from a country like Australia, where we're not known for our winter sports, do you get many people comparing you to the Jamaican bobsled team?
Yeah, we try to avoid that comparison, but of course, because of the lack of ice in Australia, they definitely compare us with the Jamaicans and Cool Runnings and all that.
Do you hate that?
I mean, we prefer to be our own individuals and not be compared, but if it helps people understand it.
Yeah, well, it begs the question, as an Australian, and I know that you're from Perth, how did you get into bobsled racing?
So bobsled's actually the kind of sport that you either fall into or get recruited into. And I got recruited into bobsled by my pilot, Lucas. So I started track sprinting, and I was quite a bit heavier and stronger than most sprinters. So that's how he found me and got me to go to a testing camp, and here I am.
Right.
All these years later.
Yeah. And so how did you start training when you're living in Perth?
So on our off season, it's just a lot of speed work, strength work. But the on season, we make Calgary our base, Canada Olympic Park. They have a track there, an indoor ice house.
Okay, and what's it like actually racing a bobsled? You know, you're standing there beforehand warming up and you push that bobsled back and forward and then you jump in. How does it feel?
It's awesome knowing that you're the engine for the sled, but as well you have to always be on, because basically my part of the sport is 6 seconds max. So if I don't give Lucas the best possible push, then it's hard for him to drive well and get us in those top spots.
Do you have to move your weight around very carefully while they're driving the rest of that race? Is that part of the sport for you?
For the brake, it's more important to stay as still as possible, to be honest, because any sort of movement in the back of the sled can send it skidding. So ideally, you don't want to move at all.
And how fast are you going, and how does that speed feel?
This track, the last few days we've been going at about 130. It's quite technical. It's not incredibly high speed course. It has a lot of technical aspects for Lucas driving in particular.
And David, I saw a recent video that you posted on Instagram you and the 4-man team doing some training. There's a very interesting hand slapping, butt tapping kind of ritual that happens when you start your position. You get your fist together in the center. Then there's this highly choreographed series of high fives, back slaps, butt taps. What's going on there?
So the first one's a team kind of timing. So we all hit the sled at the same time. So we generally say back set up, and then we hit it together. It's based on our fists moving together. The slap's just of the brakeman. That's just a thing we like to do together without the pilot.
Just to rev each other up.
Exactly.
Sick. So when's your race, and do you have a realistic shot of winning?
Realistically, we're looking for a top 15 spot, but obviously we're always going after the medal, so we'll see what we can do.
David, fantastic to speak to you there from the Athletes Village in Pyeongchang. Thank you so much for joining us, and best of luck for the races.
Thank you very much. Appreciate it. Love talking to you guys.
David Murray there from the Australian bobsled team, and he'll be racing a bit later in the games in the two-man event. It's on the 18th and 19th of February, and the four-man is on the 24th and 25th. And Bieber from Melbourne has texted in, I've actually been bobsledding. It was one of the most exhilarating things of my life. These guys are living the dream. Well, in case you don't have sprinter's legs or you simply can't be bothered doing the training required to be an Olympic athlete, there is another way you can get to the Winter Olympics and get involved. You can volunteer, and there's over 15,000 volunteers from all around the world working at the Games, including some Australians, and we've got one of them on Skype. Her name is Sammy Korn, and she's a 28-year-old Aussie ski instructor who's there helping build the downhill ski race courses. Sammy, thanks so much for joining us.
Hey, no worries. Thanks for having me.
Tell us exactly what you're working on.
So I'm based up in Yongpyeong, which is on the mountain, and they basically have the giant slalom, and team events up there. So I've been preparing the race piece, basically where the races will be skiing down.
And that's a really carefully groomed bit of snow, right? So it requires a lot of work?
Yeah, it's a lot of work. I think people definitely underestimate the work that goes into ensuring it's the right kind of snow and the right conditions for the athletes to race on. It's about making it, you know, an icy piece so that the racers can get the right edge and they can ski down it, and it's a fair piece for everyone.
So what's that work like? Because I imagine it's freezing up there in the mountains.
It's freezing. It's these last few days in particular have been close to minus 38.
Wow.
Up on the top. Yeah.
And so how did you get into the situation? I know that you've been basically ski instructing and race coaching for around 10 years. Basically, you're living the eternal winter dream, which I'm very jealous of, actually. But how did you get into volunteering at the Winter Olympics?
Just through working in the industry. I also went to Sochi as a spectator, the 2014 Games in Russia, and just had such a good time. It was such a good vibe there, and everyone was just so excited that I came back to London, where I was living at the time, contacted the organising committee and got the information on how to apply in 2 years' time for the Olympics now.
What did you have to say? Did it help that you were involved in the ski industry?
It did, yeah. I went through, as I'm living in New Zealand and working there, I went through some contacts there, and here I am.
Right, okay. So you got a bit of a leg up because you knew people in the industry.
I did, yeah.
Yeah. I mean, for people listening right now, do you think they would necessarily need that, or do you know lots of other people that just, you know, applied and got straight through?
Oh, certainly. You could just apply through their normal website as well. There's certain qualities they look for. So everyone here is just, you know, very happy and excited and want to be here and want to work on the events.
Yeah. And what is it like being there? You know, how much time are you spending working up there on the icy mountain, and what happens when you come down? What's the vibe like around the area?
So at the moment, it's a 5 a.m. start. We get the bus up the mountain and we watch the sunrise from the top up there, which is beautiful.
Wow.
And then we start work, basically, whatever we're doing for the day. We get a few breaks in between, and everyone's, you know, that's still really excited feeling, and you're working on different race pieces and different jobs each day. So by the end of the day, you know, we come back down, we eat dinner together and we hang out and relax and get ready for the next day.
And you're working with people from all around the world?
Yes, we're working with a lot of Koreans, local people, then Russians, people from Belgium, Switzerland, Finland, all over.
And what's the main skiing event that you're interested in watching?
Definitely the giant slalom. That'll be where I'm working as well.
So if you see someone come off, will you be wondering if you'd left a little bump on the piece?
No. So after every couple of races, we'll be on our skis and we'll slip down around the course and just try and smooth out any ruts and push any extra snow out of the way. So hopefully they're all good races and no injuries.
Yeah, absolutely. All right. Have a great time, Sammy. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks a lot.
Hack. Triple J.
Sammy Korn, an Aussie ski instructor who chases a winter all year round. She has been for 10 years, and there she is volunteering at the Winter Olympics. On the text line, Tom, are you asking about Olympic volunteering for a friend? Pretty much for myself. I'm pretty jealous of Sammy right now and her life. Incredible. She mentioned there that her favourite event is a giant slalom. And if you don't know what that is, it's one of three slalom skiing events where you have to ski downhill, turning through a series of gates or poles at speed. Of the three types of slalom, there's super giant slalom or super G, which is the fastest of the three. Giant slalom has the tighter gates, so it's more technical. And then slalom is the most technical with the tightest turns. Oh, we're going to learn so much about these epic sports. I can't wait personally.
Hack on Triple J.